joining us with a rich tapestry of experience and exposure. This week's guest joins us in the boardroom from the world of strategy consulting and venture capital, and she's got a radical view on how Africans can build businesses that make a difference. Dr. Kristin Wilson spent her early professional life studying modern thought and literature, African studies, and neuroscience at leading institutions like Oxford, Princeton, and Stanford. And she's led a tangentially different career in management consulting and venture capital. In this episode, we discuss the ways that culture and history play a huge part in how businesses across various societies build for success. And as a champion of African entrepreneurship in particular, Kristin also unpacks a fascinating model as to how we can begin to move the needle as a continent by embracing our core values, our strengths, and our collective identity. All of this while appreciating some of our nuances. Join us in the boardroom to unravel a colorful fabric of psychology that drives our society, politics, and business in Africa. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Boardroom Banter podcast. Listen in, and we hope you enjoy. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are, wherever you are. Welcome to the Boardroom Banter podcast. You're joining myself, Sean Karanja, and my fantastic co-host, Mr. Boniface Omina, this lovely sunny day in Nairobi. Boniface, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Sean. It's a lovely sunny Friday. So after a very long week, we get a chance to sleep an extra 2 hours tomorrow. So that's what I'm looking for. But yeah, super excited and happy to be here.
Tell me adulting is starting to kick in without telling me. Like, you're excited about an extra 2 hours. No, definitely. I'm trying not to have too many meetings or whatever this weekend. I really just want to chill. The weather's been fantastic in Nairobi, and yeah, our weeks have been fantastic. We've been having really awesome conversations here on the podcast. This is actually our second recording back to back. So Boniface and I have spent a bit of time here, and interestingly enough, we have a really, 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 really fantastic guest in the boardroom today who, I mean, guys, can we even start to quantify? You know, when we went through her LinkedIn, just the list of things that she's accomplished, the spaces that she's ventured into, and it looks like lots of experiments as well in terms of positioning, education-wise, career-wise. So today's guest, none other than Kristin Wilson, is going to be talking to us a bit about her journey. Kristin, welcome to the boardroom. It's amazing to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm really glad to be here with both of you and just to, you know, connect and share a little bit. And I think you're exactly correct about experiments. That's, I think, what I've spent the last decade or so doing, is just, you know, testing things out, you know, saying why not, instead of saying no or I don't know, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, as it stands right now, you serve as the chief strategy officer at Spart, whilst maintaining a, you know, bit of early stage investment experience and hands-on work that you do at We Capital, as well as Innovate Africa Fund and Bold Angel Fund. So while you do help startups on the day-to-day figure out their business processes, try and be as efficient, profitable, and strategic as possible, you've also got your investment hat on, where you try and put capital behind some of, you know, the most prolific entrepreneurs around. So really interesting to dig into a bit about who you are. But I mean, you know, we could list a bunch of stuff we've seen on your LinkedIn, but we want to open the floor to you, Kristin. Who is Kristin? If we bumped into each other in a cafe and, you know, this wasn't a podcast, it didn't feel like an interrogation. who would you say Kristin is?
Who am I? I think this is why I don't even like, I never do job interviews because I always struggle to answer that question. But I think I'm a learner and a seeker, right? I think that's always been the easiest way to kind of characterize myself is just I'm super curious, and I'm like a sponge. I love to pick up new skills, learn new things. I just have a moment. I wake up and I'm like, hey, I want to learn how to do this thing. And then I just work on it. So I remember even getting involved in, venture capital specifically was just like a decision I made one day. I was like, hey, I want to learn how to do this. And so I did the work. I put myself out there. I got involved. And so I think really that's the easiest way to sort of describe me as just a learner and a seeker. And I try to be brave. I try to do things afraid. And I think that's sort of what has allowed me to have a very experimental and diverse career, I suppose.
Sounds beautiful. Can we to unpack more of that? I love recording this podcast when I'm in Nairobi, because I do it in my parents' house, and more specifically in my sister's room. So that's a background that you're seeing. That's not my sister's room, but the reason I bring this up is because, I think back to my childhood experiences and growing up as the last born of five. A lot of what I picked up over the course of my early years was as a result of, looking at what my older siblings are doing. And at some point in time, we moved to the United States. So that also really changed what that environment looked like and the people who were in that environment. And a lot of this really contributed to, the fact that I'm hosting a podcast, but also more so just the worldview that I have from some of these childhood experiences. I love to draw that correlation between your childhood experience, Christine, and the work that you do. For us to understand who you are today and the work that you do, what do we need to know about your early childhood experiences and some of the environments that really shaped the person that you are today?
Oh, that's a good question. Because I don't think about that a lot. I mean, so my mother's an accountant, trained accountant, chartered, that kind of thing. And she actually is well, I well actually I think she deserves some credit for this because even though my mom basically worked in one institution for most of her career, because she's like very corporate, very professional. I think that within the context of that institution, my mother did do a lot of different things. So she did, even though she was like, she started off in financial control, obviously as an accountant. She did HR, she did operations, she did investment banking, she did microfinance, she did agency banking. So I would say that maybe that spirit of adventure, even just looking at my mom's career. Is then sort of like carried forward in what I like how I approach my career. It's just I think I do it on a slightly wider scale because I think my mother did it within the confines of an institution, and I think I just do it anywhere in the world and at different organizations. But I think yeah, definitely she deserves credit for that. But I think that the bigger credit is really that I had my dad died when we were young. My dad was an entrepreneur. He was a businessman, but I mean, I was really young, so I don't know too much about how much of his work and his life would have, sort of shaped how I see things. And actually, while he was alive, we were super sheltered, so didn't really do that much. But there was a lot of travel whilst we were young. I mean, throughout my life, travel is like a prominent feature. I'm almost always on a plane at this rate, I think. I took a break during the sort of COVID years, but right now I average probably a flight every 10 days or something. So definitely a lot of travel as a child, even now. But I think the thing about my mother that I think is really the deciding factor here is that she really just let us be us. I think for a lot of people, family shapes them in a specific way, right? So your parents are doctors, so you become a doctor. Your parents or your family are lawyers, so you become a lawyer. You're exposed to certain things in almost like an intentional way. So it's either there's like a firm hand guiding you in a certain direction or a soft hand guiding you in a certain direction. But I think my mother's approach was very, very different. I mean, she really let us do all kinds of things, you know, taking ballet, taking animation classes, you know, going to, I studied the sciences for a long time. I wanted to be a doctor. But then I was also really, really interested in, you know, biological engineering, you know. So, you know, I say to my mother one day, like, hey, I want to go study at Columbia. I want to go work in these labs. They're doing these really cool things, you know, in with pluripotent stem cells. And she's like, okay, sure, go ahead. You know what I mean? Or I say to my mom, oh, Mae Jemison, who's like one of the first Black astronauts in space, I think definitely the first female astronaut, is having this program on just like climate and, you know, climate awareness. And I think I was like 12 or something at the time. And my mother's like, okay, how can I support you and like make this happen? You know, she supported me to, you know, I was very obsessed with classical Japanese history. So I spent a lot of time in, you know, in Japan and in East Asia, visiting temples and just doing, honestly, I don't know if we're allowed to swear, but like weird shit. And I think she was just like very supportive and just let us be us. And my sister sort of has the same experience. She also in her career got to do lots of different things. And so, but I think my sister is more like my mother, and I think we'll end up taking a more sort of like corporate professional path. But I think fundamentally that space, that just like, you know, I say to people sometimes in a different context, not necessarily in the context of why I am the way I am, but just about my childhood, is that while there were complexities and certain things were more difficult than others, I really did feel like I grew up in an open field. And I really did feel like, you know what, I could do anything I wanted to do as long as I was like brave enough to take up the challenge and like, you know, willing to push through, because there really were just like no boundaries, right? There was not like, oh no, you can't do this or you shouldn't do that. Or, you know, I remember even when I decided I wasn't going to be a doctor anymore, which as you can imagine, African parents, it's like, what are you going to do instead? You know, and all of that. But my mother was, I mean, she was visibly hurt and she was very concerned. She thought I was like having a mental breakdown probably. But there wasn't like, oh no, or there wasn't like, you know, there was just concern. It was like, okay, what are you going to do? Like what's your path going to be? And the answer for me was, I don't know. And I feel like the fact that I had a parent that let me not know, and didn't make me feel incompetent or insecure about not knowing, was just like a huge gift. And so I think a lot of that is who I am and like why I've been able to do the things that I've been doing, and why I really feel like I'm allowed to figure it out. You know, I'm allowed to just take it, you know, one step or 12 steps at a time, whatever feels comfortable. And I think the North Star for me is just to do my best and to learn. I feel like I'm always on the right path if I'm putting in, you know, 100% and I'm learning. You know, that's actually for me the indicator of if I'm doing something right. So if I start to feel like, I only want to give 40% to this, or, you know, I'm not learning anything, then I know it's time to switch. And that's kind of just how I've built and how I do the things that I do.
That's really fascinating. And I can also see that exploratory spirit and just curiosity about learning in your education background. So, you know, we see that you were in Ghana, right? For your
IGCSEs. Yeah. So I did all of that stuff.
At SOS.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, at that troublesome institution. So I did the IGCSE. And then I did
I have IU. Some friends who went there.
Yeah. What'd you think of them? Any good?
Yeah, no, they're great human beings. So I think it's a great place. Then afterwards, you did a quick stint at Harvard for a bit, East Asian Studies. I'm seeing also Princeton University, where you did your bachelor's degree in comparative literature, East Asian Studies, neuroscience.
Yeah, I'll
And
tell you a
then,
funny story. I
oh yeah.
matriculated as an engineer and then switched into molecular biology. And then in my third year, my junior year, so just the penultimate year, I switched into comparative literature. So
Oh man.
essentially, that was the path, right? So it's so funny because the comp lit people, they're like, yeah, we don't know Kristen. She was here for like a year.
She just came and went.
I came and went, but it was about the time that I switched and decided I wasn't going to be a doctor anymore. And a
Interesting.
bunch of things happened. My professors were leaving the university. I was like, I'm not gonna do. So the initial plan for me was to do a so there's like a thesis that you do, right, for your undergraduate degree. And in molecular biology, which was my department, it's extreme. Like you have either a library dissertation or a lab dissertation, and I was already like gung ho. I was going to do a lab dissertation. And then my advisors, like the people that I would have wanted to be my advisors, kind of were leaving the university, so they wouldn't be available to be my advisor. So if I was going to do a lab, then I would have to do something in biochemistry. And the idea of doing a library dissertation made me want to shoot myself. So I was like, you know what? I have other interests and I have other skills, so I'm going to change my major. And then I think that process was around the same time that I was also just like interrogating a lot. So in the US, I don't know how familiar you are with like the US process of becoming a doctor, but like that whole process of applying to medical school post undergrad. You have to have all these things. Like you have to have spent time in hospitals and shadow doctors and volunteered and blah blah blah. And so I'd spend a lot of time in hospitals. I'd done thousands of hours just shadowing doctors in the US and France, on the continent. And I just realized that it just didn't seem like it would be the right fit for me. I there were so many issues, both sort of like philosophical as well as just practical. Like I thought about how much my education was going to cost. I wanted to be a surgeon. I wanted to be a cardiothoracic surgeon. And I thought about how much it would cost to train me, how much it cost for people to have surgery. I thought about the fact that I knew that I didn't want to live in the US. I wanted to live on the continent. I was like, who would be able to pay for these surgeries that I would be doing? And I just I it was extremely unsettling for me because it was like, if this is a path I'm going to choose, then I actually can't live on the continent for at least another 20 years, right? Because maybe then I would save enough money to then build my own facility on the continent and blah 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 blah. But I was like, I don't want to spend more time in the West. I want to go back home sooner rather than later. And so it was just not practical for me to sort of keep pursuing that journey. But yeah, so I switched over, and Complet was one of like the most kind of flexible departments, just in terms of how they looked at your credits and what would count toward the degree. So I joined them the second semester of my junior year. And yeah, so I didn't get to meet many, many people, but it is what I have my degree in. So it's funny because when I meet
Interesting.
people in Complet, sometimes they're like, Kristen, I don't know. Like,
Yeah,
wait,
was
is
she
she
there?
actually a second part? When I was there, I
And
promise. I was
that's
there in
okay.
theory, on
And I see
paper.
that, and I see that after that, you did your master's in African studies.
Yes.
That's pretty fascinating. Tell us a bit about that, because you did your master's at Oxford after finishing at Princeton. And then most
Yeah.
recently, you did your PhD in modern thought and literature.
Yeah.
So something about that literature and something about taking a step back and interrogating society was interesting to you. What was that about? And do you
Yeah,
are those
so
things that you use today in your day-to-day
yeah,
life?
actually a lot. The things that I use a lot. So I'll tell you about the African studies thing. So right after Princeton, I went back to Harvard and I was doing some stuff in biophysics. And I was thinking a lot about just like my Princeton experience, comparing it to the Harvard experience. And so by the time I was leaving Harvard, I sort of felt, hey, I know all these things about European history, all these things about East Asian history, all these things about American history. At that point, so I'd started a project when I moved to the US where I was visiting like as many American states as I could. So I think at that point I had done about 30 states or something. And so I had all this context and all this historical and current political context about everywhere except the continent. And that kind of bugged me. And so I thought, you know what, I need to go get an education. I was skeptical about Oxford being, you know, England being the place to get an education about Africa. But, you know, the claim was that it was one of the best African studies programs. So I applied. But before I went, actually, so I applied that, I think somewhere around 2014, but I didn't go until a year later because I then actually moved to Nigeria because I was like, you know what, let me go live on the continent. Let me travel. Let me do stuff. So I spent time, a year sort of working and traveling on the continent. And then I went to go get this African studies degree. And then after that, and really in the process of working on that MSc, I started to think a lot more about two things, I think, global politics and cosmology, right? So this idea of cosmology is basically world making, right? How do we build the worlds around us, right? And I don't know if you guys
are familiar with the IB.
Thanks. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the IB, but there's this thing in IB called theory of knowledge, which is essentially
TOK.
TOK, exactly. And it's essentially epistemology, right? How do we know what we know? And so I was sort of thinking about those epistemological questions that we've been considering since high school, the cosmological questions that, you know, shaped obviously me growing up, being in the US, being in the UK, being in Asia and all of that. And just all the different ways in which people world make, right? And I think being in Asia in particular is interesting because the cosmological standpoint is so different. It's decidedly not Western, right? I think so, like, especially when you're like middle class, upper middle class African, I think sometimes your experience, your upbringing can be very Western if we're being honest, right? But being in Asia was just like so far away from that. And so it just got me thinking about, you know, how do we know what we know? How do we build the worlds that we build? And how much of like language, right, and text is critical to that, right? Because I also think about Africa as a place, right, the continent, and obviously the continent is not homogeneous, right? But I'm saying Africa as an object, so to speak, is extremely sort of like dehistoricized, right? So there's just so much about our histories, so much about our cultures that we just don't know. We're not really taught it. I mean, the module on African history in when I was in high school was tiny and optional, right? But we did all of this stuff on, you know, Western histories. And so I just wanted to think about that intentionally. And then I had this sort of thread around healthcare and well-being that had sort of followed me since I was a child, because I wanted to be a doctor. And one of the main reasons I wanted to be a doctor was because I'm obsessed with wellness, right? I'm actually obsessed with the idea of what it means to be well, right? Not just physically, but just like as a human being, right? Like I joke to my friends sometimes that like, deadass, I'm not well. And I don't mean it in the sense of like, I'm feeling sick or something, but like there's an imbalance, right? Like just, you know, something's off kilter. And so I thought about that a lot and I wanted to write about what it means to be well and like how these different cosmological frameworks tell us what it means to be well, right? So I think about sort of the American context or the Western context of, you know, being well means, you know, not having viruses or bacteria or something in your blood. Being well means maybe not having to take medications, right? For, I don't know, ADHD or OCD or schizophrenia or whatever. Like, and I was thinking about what it means like in Asia, right? All these ideas around like chakras and chi and balance and, you know, what does it mean on the continent, right? And all the things that we say about like family and like your village people and all of these things. And I just, it's a kind of it's always in the background of my head, is like, am I doing well? Am I well? Am I feeling well? Are the people around me well? And what does that really mean? So even though these are very, very different ways of kind of tackling and exploring all of that, fundamentally for me, I was just curious. I wanted to understand. When I was young, the term sort of like third culture kid was really like popular. And it was this idea of growing up in different places and having to sort of like experience and navigate almost as a pseudo native different cultures. And I think that TCK experience, just for me, because I'm curious and because I'm a learner, it kept raising questions for me. And so that's what school was about. You know, it was about saying, how do I find an intentional space to think about these things, right? Because I think as a person, I've always been, to put it simply, switched on, right? Some people are able to kind of go through the world and like do the motions and not think about it too closely every time. Maybe occasionally they'll have those moments where they're like in deep reflection. But like, I'm constantly overthinking things. I'm constantly trying to, you know, parse things. What does this really mean? Like, I like, some of my closest friends always kind of like tease me for just like always making things like political or philosophical, or like, you know, like my partner will always laugh at me because we'll be watching a TV show and then I'll start making a critique about like blackness and like the obsession with like, you know, death and black bodies. And it's like, dude, we're just trying to watch a comedy here. You know what I mean? So I'm that person, right? Like, I'm just constantly, like, my brain is constantly thinking about subtext. It's constantly thinking about histories and stories and how those stories affect our present and how they might affect our future. And so I wanted a way to intentionally think about that, right? To be disciplined and systematic about thinking about that, so that I had actual knowledge. Because that's another thing for me, right? I think that especially in the world of like media and the internet and now AI, we can pretend or act like we know things even when we don't know them. But I think I've constantly existed with this fear of being a charlatan. So it's like super important to me to actually know what I'm saying. And to actually take the time to read and learn and understand and think about things. So that was school. And the intersection with work, which is something that's always like strange to people, because they're like, I don't get it. You're doing all these weird, like literary, philosophical, social science type things. And then you're doing all this really sort of core finance business type work, like make it make sense. But I think for me, it completely makes sense, right? Because money makes the world go round, right? Like fundamentally, right? Capital is cachet. And so I unlike say things like data, money has a perspective, money has a lens, money has a voice. And so for me, it's thinking about, okay, who gets to make money, how, right, when, what are the things that people who have money, what do they do, right? How do we create wealth? Like, the fundamental mission of my work and my life is helping people to create prosperity. That is why I do what I do, right? Because I think, again, going back to talking about part of the reason that I steered away from becoming a doctor, because I thought about the money. I thought about who pays for this, who can pay for this. And I think for me, supporting entrepreneurs, whether it's through, you know, advisory or like, you know, technical product support or, you know, implementation or financing, it's all about this question of like, who can afford the things that our world says they need to afford so that they can have decent lives, right? And how do I contribute to that? Because I think this luxury, coming back to this idea of cosmology and world building, this luxury of making your world your own, this luxury of saying, you know what, I'm not going to be westernized. I'm going to, you know, as a nation, as a continent, as a people, I'm going to write my own history, I'm going to tell my own stories, is extremely tied to capital, right? We exist the way we do on the continent because we need capital, right? Whether it's aid or it's FDI or it's remittances or whatever, we're enslaved to capital and the so-called lack of capital, right? Because we're not under-resourced, right? We're extremely over-resourced. But the resources are not capital, right? In that one-to-one correlation. And so then for me, it's a question of how do you create capital, right? How do you empower people? How do you make sure that you are building a generation, a cohort of young people who are then able to say, this is what world building looks like for us, right? This is who we are. These are our stories, right? And we don't need to shape them or frame them in a different way. I was extremely excited by the way that like the Japanese sort of cultural aesthetic interacted with the world at large, right? It's decidedly distinct, but it's still legible, right? And I think there's a huge illegibility that's ascribed to the different, you know, cultures that we have on the continent simply because we lack capital, right? Simply because our resources are not being translated to capital for us, right? And so that lack of capital means that we have to set aside our stories, right? And then transcribe ourselves in ways that are legible for the people that are keeping the lights on and, you know, keeping the bills paid and doing all of those things. And I wanted my work, my life's work, really to kind of interpolate that and contribute in a different way to that. And I think that there's an important, just, you know, zooming out for a second, there's an important legacy for us as sub-Saharan Africans with, you know, the independence movements and all of the writing some of our leaders wrote, you know, did about class struggle and neocolonialism and all of that. And I think that like as a young, in the modern era, we're young, right? I mean, we're, you know, very old, but in the modern era, our democracies and our republics and whatever are pretty young. But I think as young countries and as a young continent, they're just important cosmological questions that have to shape the way that we do work. And I actually think separating them can be dangerous. I think separating them is why we have leadership that constantly makes bad choices, right? And leadership that constantly makes short-term choices. Because if you look at, for instance, the histories in Asia, of, you know, of independence, of reformation, they're so tied to identity, so tied to identity. Whereas if you look at our histories, they're not at all, right? They're tied to capital. They're extremely bourgeois. They're extremely sort of like flattened, right? It's like super 2D. And I think for us, I think it's just important, at least for me, that changes a little bit and that shifts a little bit. And that we understand what we're doing as entrepreneurs, we understand what we're doing as creatives, as professionals, as also being political, and as also being about rewriting ourselves and making sure that we're legible, and that we're not sort of like losing ourselves in the process of just trying to make capital. So that was a really long rant, but I hope I like made it.
No, you did. You did, definitely. I think I love your mindset, Christine, and the critical and reflective questions that you're bringing to the forefront. And I'd love to understand how, with the landscape on the African continent and, you know, a lot of the advancements and evolutions that we're seeing in technology, I'd love to understand how you packaged not just what you're passionate about, but a lot of these different interests that you have into the work that you're doing today with Spirit. How have you seen sort of the landscape, the technology landscape, change and evolve on the continent from the lens of the work that you do on a day to day?
Yeah. So in terms of how that's packaged and how that shows up, I think it's in the small choices. It's in the small details, right? It's choosing to support projects that move us forward, right? So there are just certain projects we don't take, not because a client isn't going to pay, but because I just don't see, like, the key bono just doesn't make sense to me. I think it's also the choice of, like, how we let people's voices be heard in our approach, right? So we make sure that so my background as a professional is, like, management consulting, right? And the approach of management consulting is, like, very template driven, right? There's a bunch of templates and we have to, like, fit it into these frameworks. And, you know, it's like finding the right slide to tell the right blah, 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 right? That's the thing, right? And that's how we problem solve for the client. And I think for me, something that stuck with me instead was design thinking and this idea of having, like, deep, deep, deep empathy in the approach to problem solving. So rather than saying, okay, I have this template, or I have this framework, the 7 S's of S or the 5 P's of C or whatever, instead of starting from there, starting from empathy, right? Starting from really trying to unpack and understand whatever my client or whatever, you know, problem we're seeing, and then saying, okay, how do we build something that's actually custom for that, right? How do we actually go from, so that it's not just like fitting a problem into a template, but actually problem solving in a way that feels sustainable and feels authentic and brings the organization forward. You know, like one of my favorite things that happened with one of our clients, you know, when we first started working with them, they had this really like shoo-shoo French name. And, you know, they just had this whole thing. And I mean, I loved what the business did, but their whole aesthetic for me felt like aspirational in the wrong way. And then one time she just called me and she's like, look, I want to change the name of my company because it's not actually true to like who we are and what we do. And I felt like they're getting it. They're getting it, right? Because messaging matters. But so it's not like I never go to my clients and I say, oh, you need to like change your messaging or your branding. But the way that we work with them, the way that we position, the kind of like just the approach, the systemic thinking, you know, it helps us to sort of, I think it helps them to start to think about like the big picture. You know, I'll give you another example. We worked with a lender. And obviously when you're lending, you want to make money, right? Because you make money on interest. And predatory lending is so easy to do, right? But like pushing back on that with your clients and saying, okay, how do you build a profitable, sustainable, and scaling business that doesn't undercut your community, right? That doesn't paralyze business owners or paralyze individuals because they need access to your debt, right? And making that question an important business question, not just like a question for charity or a question for ethics, but a question for business. Right? That if you're saying that you have something that's valuable, if you're saying that this lending thing that you're doing has real value, then maybe you don't have to be predatory about it. Maybe it doesn't have to extort, right? And then how can you construct that value in a way that allows you, of course, to keep the lights on, to pay the bills, to scale, to make money, right? To build wealth, right? But also then uplifts your community and make sure that, like, you know, people are not like killing themselves just trying to pay off the interest on a loan that they've taken from you. And there's no template for that. There's no 7 C's of 6 whatever template for that. So that's how it fits in the work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Totally.
A question that's coming to mind right now is, you know, given that you have often taken, you know, a very anthropological view on different societies, different cultures, be that through your studies or by virtue of work and just living in multiple places. I'm really curious as to how that has influenced the way you perceive and understand how different these different spaces do business, right? So you were in the West, you studied there, worked there as well. You also went to the East, right? You were in Asia working, studying, and, you know, doing research there. You also came to Africa again, worked, studied, did research here. I'm curious about some of the parallels that you saw in terms of how people do business in these different places, but also the ways that we differ greatly, because sometimes we don't really understand that, hey, these different places have their own ways of living, ways of doing business. And as you guys work on the strategy side of how people can be successful, like how have you seen that play in its different ways, East versus Africa versus West?
Yeah, in fact, I would actually say that I think the difference isn't racialized, it's actually cultural, right? So the way in which, so like the communities and the societies in which people grow up, I think more importantly shape them than even what their racial, you know, identities are supposed to be. And I think the differences have a lot to do with dignity, actually. Right. And what I've been calling legibility. Right. What is appropriate in culture A versus culture B all boils down to what it is that makes people feel like they're being respected. Right. That makes people feel like they're getting a good deal and that they're not being shafted. Right. So the way that you would approach a negotiation with Japanese business people would be different from the way that you would do it with Chinese business people, would be different from the way you would do it with Kenyan business people versus Ghanaian business people versus Nigerians, right? Like, you know, we're constantly talking about like Nigerians being so aggressive and, you know, just doing too much. And Nigerians are constantly wailing about like how slow Kenyans are and how slow Ghanaians are, how much time they're wasting, right? These are some of like the cultural nuances, right? Because we have different ways of doing things, right? A Ghanaian will entertain you for years knowing that they will not do business with you. They have no intention to, zero plans. They will host you, go and drink beer, do this. Nothing will get signed, right? Whereas a Nigerian, after like, you know, meeting, who's like, abeg, like, you know, what's the next move, right? What are we picking? So it's that nuance, right? And it's making sure that, like, I think, across those different cultural intersections, that you're making sure that one, you see people, and two, that you give them that respect, right? And I think that coming back to the political, that's the thing that we don't do for ourselves as people on the continent, as leaders on the continent, right? It seems like we let go of the dignity, we let go of the respect and of the legibility because we're so eager and desperate for the capital. You know, I see it so many times where it's just like, nah, just, you know, put your head down and get your bread, you know, secure the bag. And then maybe when you secure the bag, then you can give back or do good. But what people don't realize is that that process of effacing yourself, you know, day in, day out, it's not just magically going to just like, you're not magically going to become your old and like dignified and self-respecting self 30 years later because, you know, you're now a partner at, you know, Goldman Sachs or McKinsey. Like all that self-effacing that you've done along the way has fundamentally changed who you are and how you see yourself. And in some ways you're no longer legible to your own self. So I think for me, what I try to do and how that sort of shows up in work is just trying to make sure that I'm seeing people. I'm understanding the difference, I'm understanding the distinction. And I'm making an attempt to offer that respect and to make sure that there is a mutually beneficial kind of like symbiotic approach to the transaction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And boiling it all down to respect. At the end of the day, that's why someone would give you their money, right? If you have a product that you're offering them, it's that, hey, I feel like this brand respects me, or that the experience that I've gotten in acquiring this product or service has been somewhat respectful or dignified. I think that that's a very profound way of boiling down what business is at the end of the day. We often buy things to feel respectable. Like that's why you buy clothes, you buy nice clothes. That's why you'd want to buy a phone. That's why you'd want a product or service that makes your life easier, you know. So that's a very fascinating way of boiling it
down. And But I'll tell you, Sean, that it's a perspective, right? Because
right.
the other way that like a different generation has perceived this is it's about exploiting, right? So I look at it from the point of view of respect, right? And like you characterized, you know, we want to feel dignified, we want to feel respected, we want to do those things, right? But another framework has said it's exploiting that need for respect, exploiting that need to be seen, exploiting that desperation, right? So I remember growing up, like you watch all these like campaigns or ads, and they're talking about like feeding on that desire, right? And so you can take the same situation, but mindset, cosmology, framework, right, is what then says, how do you treat these people? How do you see it as an experience of creating respect or establishing respect? Or do you see it as an exploitative endeavor, right? And I think, you know, how we choose to see it then determines whether or not we end up creating something that's sustainable or creating something that, you know, makes everybody angry and destroys the planet and, you know, makes everybody frustrated and burnt out and tired. And, you know, then we have a whole generation that we're calling lazy, but it's just fatigue. You know what I mean? So this is kind of what I'm sort of speaking to, right? It's like you can take the same situation, the same needs, the same things, and you can see it as an opportunity to create respect, right? To establish and reinforce dignity. Or you can see it as an opportunity to exploit.
An interesting follow-up question there would be just about your perspective on Africa, our future. A lot of people are optimistic about Africa, but like there's a but, like a condition that, hey, I am optimistic given that we decide to pursue XYZ or we decide to establish this or that or the other. What are you optimistic about Africa? And if so, do you have a but or a condition or something that you're hoping that we'll internalize in order to get there?
Yeah, so I'll say it this way. In my normal life, I'm actually, I would say something like a I don't know, a pessimist or a realist. I would describe myself as a realist, but I think people would say maybe I'm a pessimist. I don't know. But I think when it comes to Africa, I am optimistic, but not really in the way that maybe people think about that optimism, right? So my optimism isn't so much that like, everything will be fine and like everybody's going to live in a nice house and all of these things. My optimism is more that like something has to give and it will. And when that thing gives, one needs to figure out how to be on the right side of that fracture, right? That's my optimism. We can't continue living like this. We can't continue like this exploitation, this denigration, it's just not sustainable. It will, something has to give. So it will, right? That's just like the nature of the universe. It's just like natural law, right? So the question is, what happens when it gives, right? Is it us, you know, tearing each other apart and eating each other and throwing ourselves off cliffs? Is it, you know, us coming together and building? I don't know what it's gonna look like, but this state, like this status quo, this kind of like slavery, colonialism, exploitation narrative that we've all just sort of been sitting in and trying to jackba and, you know, respectability politics our way through, it will give, right? Because we all have a natural breaking point, right? And so the question for me is, where will we find ourselves on when that fracture happens? So that's my optimism. So it's a weird kind of optimism, but it keeps me going, if that makes sense.
I think I'm really loving this conversation because it feels like we're looking at the world, not just the world, but Africa in the next 10 and 15 years and asking ourselves what kind of role we want to play in the change that we're seeing. And not just being passive and accepting what's being given to us, whether it's by government, by businesses, and so on and so forth, but actually actively leading the change and making sure our voice is part of the conversation. And that's something I think, if I hadn't gone to ALU, for instance, I wouldn't have recognized that my role as an African goes beyond just being a Kenyan in, you know, confined to the borders. My role isn't just, you know, traveling to the West or to the North or to the East, but actively contributing and participating in our progress forward. And as we come to the end of this conversation, Chris, I think the last question that I'd have for you is, what are you excited about when it comes to the future and the role that you see yourself playing in the grand scheme of things? 10 to 15 years, if you were to look back, what do you see yourself being very proud of that you participated in or contributed to?
Yeah, I think for me, it's basically supporting and like amplifying a new class of problem solver, right? Tries to take the full picture into account, right? Like for me, I'm very, very dedicated to, you know, helping people to build wealth, helping people to create prosperity in their communities, right? But not at the cost of, you know, each other, not at the cost of dignity, not at the cost of self. And I think that, you know, growing up, we were told that like, it's a zero sum game, you know, something has to give, we have to exploit the planet. How else are we going to get firewood, right? We have to exploit these people. How else are we going to survive, right? Like, I think, I don't know how much of that messaging shaped your own childhood, but like growing up, that's what we were told, that like, there's this like scarcity situation and like, it's a scramble, right? It's very Hobbesian. And the idea of it is just like, it's then the survival of the fittest. And I think I feel lucky because traveling, learning, reading, I know that that's not true. I know that there's enough, right? And I know that we can create more, right? And so being able to say that, look, my own contribution is supporting entrepreneurs, supporting creatives, supporting professionals who see the world that way, right? One of my favorite things I tell people is that whenever you try to have a critical conversation about capitalism, people jump to, well, but communism doesn't work. But like, I wasn't talking about communism. I was talking about capitalism, right? But this like artificial binary that it's like, oh, well, if it's not capitalism, then it must be like communism or socialism, which is just communism by another name or something, right? And it's like, no, like, why did we decide that like these three things were like the only thing? Why can't we just create something else, right? And I think that resisting that notion that something can't exist because it doesn't exist is so, so, so important. And when you even look at like what it is that allows people to succeed, it's their ability to imagine. It's their ability to not take what exists as all that can exist, right? And giving that gift back to us and saying, we can do that. Like, this doesn't have to be it, right? Like the end of the world through climate death doesn't have to be it, right? And we can actually just create something new and do something new. I think that's extremely important. And like, that's an important part of what I want my legacy to be, right? It's just like resisting the status quo and not like as a rebel without a cause, but as somebody who just says, because it just doesn't benefit me. Like as a Black African woman, the status quo is the least useful thing to me. I have zero incentive to take it seriously. So I won't. You know? So, yeah.
That's awesome, Christine. I love that. It's kind of giving rebel, but, you know, also a bit measured in terms of, hey, like, let's be realistic about what tomorrow looks like and, you know, just really taking up our places there and taking a stand that, hey, me taking a stand on one thing doesn't necessarily mean that like I'm fundamentally opposed to what you think the opposite of it is. But yeah, I think that's really awesome. Man, if this is what going and getting a PhD in literature, if thinking like that is what it gets me, maybe I might stop looking to go and do an MBA. Maybe the key here is to go and study literature.
No. Go do your MBA if that's what you want to do. Just be a thoughtful, MBA. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Just hear you.
As they say, stay woke. You know?
Stay woke. I hear you.
Don't fall asleep. Yeah.
So, Christine, as we come to the tail end of this conversation, we like to do a fun little segment. We call this the elevator segment, and it's a couple of quick fire questions that we're gonna ask you. And okay. So yeah, are you ready to step into the elevator?
Okay, I'm ready.
Yeah, so picture this. We've just had a great conversation in the boardroom. We're leaving, and one of our enthusiastic interns hops into the elevator with you, and whether you like it or not, you're stuck with this intern all the way down, and they have a couple of quick fire questions to ask you.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Okay. Yes.
Awesome. So the first one is there a book or publication that changed your life or perspective significantly that you'd recommend us all to pick up and read?
Oh, there's so many. Wow. But I think the book that I would recommend right now is it's a book called Class Struggle in Africa. It's by Kwame Nkrumah. That's the book I would recommend right now. Yes.
Nice. Awesome. Second question. If you could drop everything right now and start a startup, so putting your money where your mouth is, it's going to be funded.
I already run a startup.
Totally new one.
Okay, so, totally new one. Okay.
So gun to your head, you have to build a unicorn. And it has to be something you've not done before or in the past. What would you build?
It would be something around storytelling, actually. And I think particularly in this kind of world of AI and all of that, maybe something that allowed people to kind of like a product that allowed people to imagine something and then realize it, right? And so they could like live in their fantasy for 30 minutes or a day. Like they would pay and, they could just like live in that fantasy. I would do something like that, maybe.
Yeah, Kristen, you're onto something there. Those who have ears, listen.
Yeah.
It makes sense, actually, now that the Vision Pros have come out.
Exactly, right? So I feel like we're in a world where we can make this happen, right? If you could dream something in your mind, and we could figure out how to extract that dream, translate it into AI, and then create that reality, and you could live in it for some time, I think that'd be very rewarding for people. Yeah.
I think, Christine, you've given up on the real world. You're like, man, let's just build some.
It's not ideal. Even that. I think imagination is so important for creation. You know.
Yeah.
So it's not even I don't even see it as escapism, right? I see it as motivation, right? Because I think you have to be able to like hold in your head that like something different is possible, because that's the only way you can then like start to build that different thing. You know.
True.
Yeah.
Final two questions from our intern, Christine. What is something that you cared about in your 20s that you don't care about anymore today?
Oh, that's a good one. I think being seen as respectable, I guess. I think in my 20s, I was still sort of caught up in respectability politics, right? And I think now that's like just not important. Like, I think being respectful is more important than being seen as respectable. You know?
I like that. Last question. Most podcasts usually ask a question. What is the best advice you've ever gotten in life? Yada, yada, yada. But in the boardroom, we don't care about that. We want to know the worst piece of advice that you've ever gotten, Christine, that you'd advise our listeners never, ever, ever listen to.
I think the worst advice that somebody ever gave me, and I think they were well-intentioned when they did, right? But they said, Kristen, you're very vocal and you have strong opinions, but sometimes in life you just have to put your head down and just follow the crowd. You don't have to stand out. And then they ended it very poetically with this. I think it's a Chinese proverb that the nail that sticks out gets hammered in. I don't know if you know
Oh,
that
yeah.
proverb. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know they meant well, right? Because I was a bit of a troublemaker. But I think it's terrible advice. All right. I think, look, if my name was Jessica and I was like white, fitting in might work for me, but it's not. So, no, I'm not gonna do that. Thank you.
That's crazy. Yeah, no, I do hear that, and I see it also a lot in terms of how schools are set up. One of my high schools growing up, they were really against that thing of like you just expressing yourself and being out there. You know, there was something about extroverts that I think they just didn't like. So extroverts are always the ones in trouble. Something about like being outspoken and just like having a big voice and wanting to interact and being out there was seriously discouraged. And I only realized that now when I was, you know, much older, realizing that hey, certain nails that stick out, they do tend to get hammered. And instead of being appreciated, like, hey, nice nail there, you know. And it is who you are. Anyway, Christine, that brings us to the end of our conversation here. I hope that you've had a fantastic time in the boardroom. We definitely have enjoyed your presence here. You've urged us to think deeply about our biases and the different lenses that we look at life and business through. You've really encouraged us also to use our careers and education as a laboratory for experiments. And yeah, definitely. I think we're leaving this conversation having a stronger sense of patriotism to our mother Africa, hoping that when things break, we're on the right side of that thing, because something does have to give. I agree with you. Yeah, Kristen, we do you have here we just let We let people, you know, plug themselves. Is there anything that you're up to or anywhere that you'd like people to follow the work that you're doing or support in any way?
Okay, for a plug, yeah, I mean, check out what we're building at Spurt and give us your feedback, send us your business. Let us help you build. That's always fun. Because I believe in entrepreneurship and I believe in wealth building. I don't think sitting down and packing up is the answer. I think we need to create. So yeah, I would be happy to support you on your journey, any sort of entrepreneurs or dreamers or creators out there. So check us out at Spurt.
Awesome. We've got lots of dreamers and entrepreneurs in our community. And to all our listeners today who have listened in, if you've reached this far, we want to give you a big shout out. Thank you for joining us on another Boardroom Banter episode. I've been your host, Sean Karanja. We were joined in the boardroom by none other than Boniface Omina and Madam Christine Wilson. Thank you so much, Christine, for your time. And to our listeners, have a fantastic week and don't stop dreaming.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Hey there, folks. We're wrapping up today's episode with a quick one from our sponsors, Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world. directly sourced from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. We're proud to be sponsored by them, and at the end of our episodes, we like to wind down, and we cannot think of a better way to wind down than with a cup of hot Nepal tea. So if you'd like to check them out, go and look them up at nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com for more information. See you on the next one, guys.